The Laughter Permitted podcast is brought to you by Ally. Do it right.
Welcome to season seven. I'm Julie Foudy. She's Lynn Ozawi. And this, my friends, is Laughter Permitted. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Jules.
Ah, it's so good to be back. Yes. Hope our dope village is fabulous. We missed you all and are looking forward to putting together perhaps our best season yet. Do you remember the day, actually, Lynn, when we were instead singing, "Who's got a podcast?"
We do, we do.
"Who's got a podcast?"
We do, we do.
I do remember.
And we are starting off with a trailblazer in every sense of the word.
Oh my gosh. It is hard to find actually an appropriate adjective for our first guest, Dr. Nadia Nadim, because amazing doesn't even come close. She is a pro soccer player, a doctor, as I just mentioned, UNICEF ambassador, refugee advocate, and author, just to name a few things. Nadia plays professionally here in the United States for NWSL's Racing Louisville and is a star on Denmark's national team, sitting at 99 international caps. She just got her medical degree last month, and in this podcast, she shares her story of fleeing her home country of Afghanistan with her mom and four sisters after her father, who was a general in the army, was murdered by the Taliban when she was 10 years old. It was at a refugee camp in Denmark that she got introduced to soccer, and her story does feel, even as rich as it already is, that it is in fact just starting. This is a remarkable conversation with an even more remarkable woman. So get comfortable listening. It's Dr. Nadia Nadim. Hey there, Dope Village. As y'all know, Ally has backed Laughter Permitted since day one of our podcast as our financial ally. And honestly, Lynn, I might just tattoo Ally on my forehead. And Ally is currently on a mission to change the game for women sports.
And get this, along with being sponsors of the National Women's Soccer League, Atlantic Coast Conference, United States Golf Association, and the Las Vegas Aces, Ally has committed to an equal media investment in women's and men's sports.
And you, my friends, can be part of the change by watching your favorite athletes crush it on TV, by going to women's sporting events in person, by, I don't know, maybe listening to every single episode of this amazing podcast on Trailblazing Women. Because every time you show up for women's sports, you are helping move the game forward. You can learn more about Ally by visiting ally.com. Hey there, Dope Village. Lynn and I have been involved in women's sports our entire lives. And truly, we've never been more excited for what's to come in this women's sports space. And one big reason, Ally. Ally has made a commitment to an equal media investment in women's and men's sports.
And that means more money going to women's sports and more visibility for what these incredible athletes are accomplishing. Ally is on a mission to change the game for women's sports.
So here at Laughter Permitted, we're going to keep telling the stories of trailblazing women. And every time you listen in, you are part of that change. To learn more about Ally, go to ally.com.
Kick back.
How are you?
Amazing, actually. I'm doing very well. I'm happy to be back in the States.
Yes.
Yeah, I've been busy. I've done my rehab very well. And, you know, I've been, this last week, been tested through with everything they could find. So good place physically and mentally.
And you're good to go? Like you're cleared?
I'm cleared to be a part of team trainings, but no contact yet. So I'm doing a lot of like the technical stuff, passing drills. Of course, I'm doing a lot of gym, a lot of cardio training now, because it's been only 5 months after my surgery, you know?
Yeah.
I can't really be in contact yet. I think they wanted to be, they want my, like my muscle to be a bit like bigger, especially my right leg, before I can be in contact. That's probably going to take me a month and a half to build that stability even more.
And the goal, fingers crossed, is to also play in Euros, right? Definitely. Over the summer.
I know. That's what I'm trying to.
Oh, I saw you're on 99 caps. I was checking that out.
I know. It's crazy. Before I just got injured, I was supposed to have my 100 caps. Oh. I think they were like trying to prepare something very nice. And then I just got injured. It's just like... It is what it is. You know, I'm going to have hopefully my 100 caps at the Euros or before.
I did check out your group too. I was like, oh, damn.
Our group is freaking fire. Huh? I saw it as well. I was like, shit. I know it's Spain and Germany.
I know. It's Spain, Germany, and Finland.
Yeah. I was like, damn, that's a good group. It's going to be some good games, I hope.
Oh, it's going to be good. It's going to be really good. Nadia, the first thing we always do on the podcast is we have our guests set the scene. So where they're at, what they're doing, how they're doing, all those things.
Okay, great. I mean, I am here in Kentucky, Louisville at our facilities, in our training, amazing training facilities. I've just had training and I did media. I had lunch. Now I'm here in our media room. I'm talking to you.
They really need to work on their background in their media room, I think.
I know.
I was like, wow, that's white.
It is white. It's very clean. There's a table, three chairs, TV, that's it.
Because I heard everything else there is like top notch. Let's just get a pretty little print in the background.
I know. To be honest, I think these facilities are amazing. They have literally everything. I feel very grateful to be here. Especially our canteen, the food they make is.
Oh, really?
I just told you what I was eating. Yeah. It's different level. Yeah.
You're definitely eating. Better.
I know. I'm like, yes, I'm so grateful.
That's awesome.
So Lynn and I have decided we're going into our season 7 of the podcast. We're just going to, your story is going to be the entire season 7. We're just going to do 10 episodes with you. If that's okay.
Wow. Yes. I'm ready.
We were trying to decide where to begin and we decided we're going to begin with a slow clap for Dr. Nadia Najem. Slow clap. 4, 3, 2. Seriously.
Oh, that's crazy.
Congratulations. That was just last month where you became Dr. Nadim.
It's crazy. Thank you so much. Appreciate that. I know I can't believe it myself sometimes. I'm like, oh, it took me ages. And you know, the last 3 months, probably the hardest 3 months of my life, I don't get stressed. I'm pretty sure of that. I'm immune to stress, but I think this is the closest I've ever been to feeling stressed. I was like, what's happening? And then how am I going to get through this? I'm so happy that it's over. I'm feeling so relieved. I feel literally I've lost 20 kilos, like, you know, from my shoulders. I was crying my eyes out when I just came out and they were like, yeah, this is it, Nadia. You're done. Dr. Nadim. I came out. The entire family was there, you know, and I was just crying. I'm like, oh, my God.
Of course.
My mom, what are you crying for? I'm like, I don't know.
I don't know. I'm just so happy.
It was just happiness and relief at the same time. It was amazing.
Are you putting Dr. Nadim on your jersey? I've heard you say that. Please tell me you are.
I don't know. Maybe for my first game. I don't even know if it's. Yes. Can you do this?
Yeah, you totally can do that. If they can,
I'll do it.
Okay.
How many other doctors do you see to pray? No one. So I'm going to be like the first one, I guess.
Yeah, it should actually be like, I'm a doctor. What are you? That's the whole thing I want on the back. What have you done lately? Question mark.
I'm a doctor. What's up?
I know.
I'm a doctor, bitches. What you got?
No, they just raised the roof. You're dear to my heart forever. I love it. So what inspired you to get on the journey to becoming a doctor?
I think, you know, honestly, it was a bit of a random to start with. I remember my mom always wanted me to become a doctor. And I was like, no, not going to happen. You should decide what I want to do. Like, it's my mom, but I was like, no, I'm going to do. She was like, yeah, but, you know, Asian parents are always this way. Lawyers, doctors, engineers. I was like, no, I'm going to do what I want to do. So I was pretty sure that I wasn't going to be doing business, you know, finance. I thought Wall Street, this is where I'm going to end up. But then it wasn't really me. I bought a kiosk to see how everything was working behind the scene when I was 19. And I was imagining having like 1, 2, 3, 4 entire chain, like 7-Eleven. But I was like, nah, this is too boring. I'm too young for this. So that wasn't me. And then I really wanted to become a lawyer at a certain point because I saw a movie with Tom Cruise. And I was like, this is what I'm going to be doing. He seems super cool. You know, like, this is going to be me.
I'm blanking on the movie. What? It's such a good movie.
It's where it's like, you can't handle the truth.
Come on, you need me on that wall. You want me on that wall.
A few good men.
Yes.
I Googled it.
That's a sick one. But then, you know what? I got to internship in a law company for 3 months and I just felt it was very boring. It was the same thing they're doing and I wanted to have the interaction with people. So in 9th grade, we have this 1 week in Denmark where the students are allowed to go and kind of see what kind of areas of interest they have to see how things work. And everyone obviously goes and internships places they like. I wanted to go to the nearest hospital because it was close to our house. And that way I could sleep in for an entire week. So I didn't have to like wake up earlier. So this is what I did. And I was like, wow, this is very cool. You know, I saw this surgeon doing his thing. I really enjoyed the interaction, but also the, you know, the way they were working. So when the day came, like the day I had to choose for my university, apply for the university, I was like, you know, I liked working with people. I think I also love the fact that you can help people be in a situation we have so much responsibility, you know, save someone's life eventually. And you also make a lot of money as a doctor. I was like, you know what? I think I will be a doctor. So I just wrote like, you know, medicine and then the ones university that I wanted to be in. And yeah, 2 weeks later, I got accepted and I've loved it every semester. You know, I think it's such a great thing. And I love being in the operation rooms, you know, as I said, that adrenaline pumping and you feel the pressure. You have to know things, but also you have to be smart, you know, like with your hands. I like to do things with my hands. I like that you have a problem. You come to the surgeon, the surgeon's going to fix you and the problem is gone.
That's so cool.
I know that. That interests me a lot. So I think that was kind of the background for it.
I thought you were going to say you sew them up with your feet or something like that instead of your hands, but.
Not yet.
So how in the world did you do it while being a professional athlete? And logistically, how long did it take? Geographically, you're literally all over the globe at times.
It was crazy. You know, in Denmark it takes 6 years. You have the gymnasium, that's 3 years, and that's where you kind of prepare for the university. So you need to have certain subjects. I think you guys call it pre-med, you know, but for us that's like the high school or gymnasium. So I did this 3 years and then the 6 years. 3 years is bachelor and the three last years or master's. So the bachelor part I did while I was playing in Denmark. So I did it just like, you know, from 7 to 3, I was in school. And then I used to drive an hour and a half to practice. We used to practice like later, you know, at around 6 p.m. Train, go home, sleep, repeat. And then I play games in the weekends. So that kind of was working out, but obviously very stressful. But then when I started becoming, you know, coming to overseas, it was a bit harder just because you have to be at the master's every semester. There's like 2 months of internship, which was mandatory. You have to be there. And it wasn't possible for me to attend. So it kind of extended, my studies got extended more than usually. And for me, when I was in England and Paris, it wasn't possible. I could do my, you know, my thesis, I could do research projects and all that, but I couldn't be at the hospitals. While when I was playing in the US, it was possible because the seasons are shorter. And then the semester starts in September, end of August, and then goes to January. But like the end of the semester, it's like 2 months of internship. So I used to come middle of the semester, go to the internship, and then just go to my exams. And all like the theoretical part, I was studying at home, basically. and it kind of figured out. And it took me, usually, as I said, it takes 6 years. It took me plus 10 years, I would say. But
to fit in all the residency stuff. I mean, I can't even imagine because it's hard enough being a professional athlete with timing and sponsorship commitments and national team duties on top of that. And you're traveling all the time. And so I bow to you, sister, for getting that done.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Congratulations. Let's rewind. And for many listeners on the podcast who haven't heard your incredible story, let's go back to your childhood because you were born in Afghanistan, of course, Nadia, and then you had to flee your home country when you were 11 years old. So can you take us back to that time?
Yeah, definitely. You know, yeah, born in Afghanistan, you know, raised, born in Herat, which is close to the Iranian border, because my dad was a general and we used to move around everywhere. But all my memories I have are from Kabul, the capital. Yeah, there. I think my memories are divided into the first phase. I had like a very safe childhood. You know, my mom was a lecturer in school. My dad was a general. We used to live in a very safe environment. I used to every day, like around 4 or 5 p.m. when the sun was weaker, my mom used to dress up us up and we could go downstairs and play with every other kids, you know, just be children, I guess. And then all that kind of changed, and then, you know, my memories are the last phase that I spent in Afghanistan are way different than what I had at the beginning. Taliban gained power. My dad was executed because he was a general in the former regime, and then, you know, he was a powerful man. He got removed, and then I remember, you know, being a single mother with five girls, extremely hard to have a normal living. And beside that, they also brought in all these rules in terms of that girls weren't allowed to go to school, women weren't allowed to be outside, to do daily chores, just like going groceries. So it made it extremely hard to just function and have a normal life. Forget the future. At this point, we weren't even thinking about the future. We're just like trying to have a normal life or survive at least. We tried, my mom at least tried for a long time to make it work. It didn't happen. And then at a certain point, you know, enough is enough. She sold everything we had, you know, the cars or houses, wherever, and jewelries. And found the right people to get us out of there, to try to find a better future, I guess, for us. Because I'm pretty sure if we've stayed there, you know, five girls, a single mom, not allowed to do anything. And also the way my mom's, you know, my mom is, the way she thinks and the way she's raised us, I don't think we would have lived or had a life, I guess, just because, you know, she's not okay with everything that was happening. She didn't understand why are women not allowed to go to school. Education is key. She knew this, like, since I was a child, a baby, she always said, like, education is very important, you know, and suddenly certain people coming in and telling you guys are not allowed to educate yourself. So she had, like, it was not working for her. We were low profile. We weren't allowed to very pack anything or you know, say goodbye to people. From one day to the other. We transported to Pakistan with a minivan, and in Pakistan We were there for in Karachi for a couple of months until. So this human smuggler used to come in every second week, little guy, chubby little guy with a gold chain and very dark and mustache with oily hair. He had like amazing hair, but very oily.
It's amazing you remember that.
I know. So I remember it very detailed, you know, and he used to wear like these, you know, traditional Pakistani white clothing. And he used to come every second week or sometimes every week and would say that I have these passports that will fit three of your kids. So at this point, we're waiting for him to find passports that matches our profiles. So we can leave the country with airport, like from the airport with airplane. And he would come and my mom would say, no, we want to stay together. I want my children and me to leave together. So this was going on for a couple of months. And one day he came and he said, this is it. I found a family that actually matches you or your guys' profile, a single or a mom with this amount of kids. And I don't know, I think to be honest, I think the passports when I was younger, you just had to write the names of the kids. It wasn't necessarily with the pictures. I don't know. I'm not sure.
Yeah.
But this was before 9/11. So things were a bit easier at that point.
Right.
So, and he gave us a bunch of clothes, Pakistani traditional clothes. And he said, you guys are going to wear this and make sure that no one's going to discover that you're not Pakistani, because if they do discover, you're going to end up in jail and sent back to Afghanistan. And then at that point is game over. I'm remembering that he was walking with us behind him following, just cruising through the security. I felt like everyone knew what was happening. They've been paid, you know. The next thing I know is that I'm sitting in the PIA, Pakistani Airlines, and on my way out of Pakistan. I was very excited because it was my first time flying in the airplane. The stewardess were super nice, you know. They come with like, you know, chocolate or you have to, if you want to draw anything. It was weird because in one side you're so like scared and you know you're fleeing for your life and you're at the edge, don't make a mistake. Even I'm at this point 10 years old.
Yeah.
No, the only thing was going through my mind is don't fuck up, don't let them discover. Or I'm even taking care of my younger sister. I'm like, she better not say anything. And on the other hand, I'm actually also excited because I'm like, oh, I've never seen this before. it was a weird mixture of feelings. But then, we were arrived in Italy. And then from there, we were transported to this basement by this East European guy. And the basement, which was like around 45 minutes from the airport, it was like a basement apartment with two sofa beds on the sides. At the end of it, there was like this dirty ass toilet. I've never seen anything like it. Every time, even when I think about it, I could smell it, you know. It just felt like a stop for a lot of people, I guess. Everyone has been, I think they've done that a lot of times, you know. So it just seemed very dirty and the toilet has been clogged and it was like shit everywhere. And then on the other corner of the apartment, you had a little table with toast and you could make some coffee or tea and a little screen with Eurosport showing some kind of ski hop.
Interesting. Yeah, all these little details that you remember.
Yeah, I know. I remember everything vivid. I think I have a photographic memory. Yeah. I remember also not wanting to eat or drink anything because I was scared of have to go to the bathroom.
You didn't want to go into that bathroom.
Hello, not going to happen. We were there for, I think, a day and a half. And then the same guy comes back and he's like, this is now. And we just follow after him. We sit here in his, golf car, Volkswagen. And he drove us to a parking area with where the trucks, lorries would like park. So kind of bigger than normal parking areas. And he told us, whenever I say so, you guys are going to run behind that truck. I remember being very confused, but your adrenaline is pumping at that moment. You know, you're really in the zone. Like, okay, I need, this is the mission. This is the task. And I could tell my mom was like half confused. She took the youngest one in her arms. My older sister and I, we were making sure that the two other, because we were five sisters,
yeah,
the two other ones are in like, have a hand, and then one of us are holding the back, and we were running after them. So we climbed behind a truck, and in the truck, they had made space like really in the back of the truck. And we were told not to say anything, because if we were again discovered that there are people behind the lorry, then the person, the driver, is going to be in prison and we're going to be sent back and eventually die, you know. So I think everything was very extreme. And as a kid, there are moments I'm confused, but other moments I also, you know, that this is reality. You know that this is no game. This is no joke. You don't want any attention. You don't want to know nothing. You just want to follow what's been said, and you want to do it as perfect as possible. So at this point, you know, as I said, and we've been almost getting used to do this for years now. So when my mom was saying, shh, it was like, shh, for hours.
Right, right.
So yeah, we were sitting there and the same thing. We had a bottle of water, but I didn't want to drink because then I had to pee in the corner of the truck. And I was like, there's no way I'm going to do that in front of my family. I mean, I was 10, but still had my dignity. And yeah.
Did you know where you were going?
No. So of what I know, I think is something I was told that we were going to, because we had family in England, in London. And I think the idea was for us, we never had this conversation with my mom that we're going to start, blah, blah, blah. As I said, no time for that. But I knew that we're going to London because of my family. So everyone kind of knew this is where we're going. So yeah, after I think 2 days or I don't know, more than 50 hours. I don't remember how long we were there, but I assume it's about, 2 days. We were stopped. The bus started like to, you know, move slower, and then you can feel like the swings. And
when you say 50 hours, you were in the bus that entire time?
Yeah. And he said he, you know, kind of knocked on the side of like a door, and I think was yelling us to get out. We got out. I was very confused. I was super hungry, almost like dehydrated, you know, because you're like been there for ages. It was like this little city. And for an hour or so, we were just walking around, confused. What the hell's happening? Where are we? In my mind, I was like, I thought that London was bigger. And secondly, there was food in my mind. I needed something to eat. So when I don't eat, I become a diva, I guess, because I don't remember anything. I just remember that thinking of food. But after an hour or so, my mom sees this old guy walking with his dog, and goes to him and asks where we were and where the police station was. And the guy explained to her that this was Ranas in Denmark, and police station is like in the corner of that side. And my mom came back and she said, we are in Denmark. And I was confused. I thought, what, where is that?
You're like, wait, I thought we were going to go into London.
Where is the Londoner eye? And to be honest, at that point, I didn't really care. I knew we were safe. You weren't hearing the sounds of war. And we were together. That's the most important thing. And we find the police station. My mom went up. We knocked on the door. As I said, it was super empty. It was 20th of April, which is an Easter day that year. And it was like a holiday. So everything was just like shut down. We arrived like around 4 or 5 a.m. So it was, no one was there. And there was one police officer that my mom finally found. And yes, she said that she was this person and she was seeking asylum. And then she went inside the room with him. We were sitting outside the office, I guess his office. I think this is the protocol that when people are coming in, they start to interview the first thing. who are you? What do you want? What's happening here? How do you, you know, get here?
Right.
And my mom sat there for like 45 minutes or so, like kind of like a speed interview. And then after that, he came back and he looked at us. And then, you know, I think he could kind of sense that we were hungry or dehydrated or everything. He then set us in his car, police car, and he drove us to a little kiosk where he got some milk, bananas, toast for us to have. Yeah. This guy was so nice. He's like, you know, I met him almost 20 years later.
Oh, really? Wow. The first police officer?
Yes. I've mentioned the story like probably a million times because I think he was one of the nicest person I've ever met. He had green eyes, you know, like nice hair. He was so nice. And you just felt like you're obviously super scared. You don't know what's happening. So the first person that you meet is going to make a huge impression on you. And I think he's probably the reason that I want to like become a doctor later on and wanted to help people because I saw how he affected us in that situation. I just felt cool. Or if he made us feel secure somehow in a weird way. And the kindness. I think it was 20 krona, which is at that point right now is $3, $3.50 he spent. But for me, this is like the biggest thing anyone could do for you. You're starving and he just bought you a banana and a milk. And I was like, oh my God, this guy is amazing. I know it was so emotional when I met him. I actually met him for the launch of my book. I didn't knew he was going to be there. So he kind of surprised us. And my sister was,
oh, no way.
I was like, stay strong, Nadia. Because every time I talk about this guy, I get very emotional. Because, you know, kindness or humanity is just like one little act at the end. It doesn't take much. You don't have to climb a mountain. You just sometimes is enough with acknowledging another human being, just like smiling with your eyes. It's more than enough.
Oh, I'm gonna cry.
I know. I'm trying very hard right now.
No. Oh God. So did he walk up to you and say, "Hey, I'm the police officer"? Did he introduce himself that you met that first day?
No, because he obviously we knew he was a police officer, but I remember him like doing this, and this is the International Sign for Hunger. I was like, yes, very
rubbing your stomach. Well, do you mean at the book signing?
I meant at the book signing when he saw you, know, there. What did he say?
So he came, he's like, "Do you remember me?" And I was like, because I don't know, I remember that way. Because he's 20 years long time, you know, he's getting older. But because I've spoken so much of him, I kind of knew that this is something has to do with that. And then he's like, "Yeah, it's me." Oh, his name is Åge, O in Danish. And then I was like, "Oh my God, I just can't believe this." I was like, "Oh, I just want to say thank you. You are the reason that I'm doing so much more than just being a footballer. Like, I think that you're the reason that I want to be this kind of person." I said, "You're the reason that, you know, I have this fire of, I want to do more. I want to help people. You know, you started a spark in me. I think in my family, you know, my sister is a doctor. The two youngest were nurses. I think everyone is like kind of in the same area. We want to help people."
Yeah.
So I think he plays a huge role. And I was like, I want you to know this because for you probably even remember this because whoever 20 years old and you probably met so many people since then, but you just did this and it was huge for us or for me. Yeah, it was a very nice moment. And you know, I met with him and his wife afterwards. I invited him to one of the games or the national team.
Aww.
Yeah, he told me, he's like, "I knew of you because one of my kids after one, like, I think 7, 8 years or 10 years later when I made the national team or whatever, had spoken about me that there was this family who arrived in Ghana's and the kid has asked the dad, "Were you there that day?" And he's like, "Yeah, it was me." So he knew of me before he went.
Oh my God. That is wild.
It was like a movie. And I was just in shock. I was trying very hard not to cry. I remember being very emotional. My sister was bawling her eyes out. I was like, "You should get together."
I got a book signing to do. Get your shit together.
But it went well, yeah. And from there, back to the story, I think from there, he set us on a train. And then the train went to Copenhagen. Because Ghana's is like three and a half hours away from Copenhagen, which is the capital. And in Copenhagen, you have this center called Sandholm Center, which is for everyone who comes in the country, like, you know, everyone, families, ex-criminals, everyone just goes there. It's like a prison, to be honest, because, you know, they have like huge fences with the metal things around.
Barbed wire.
Yeah, exactly. You have police officer guarding outside, and it's, you can't really in and out if you want to. So we went there, and then, you know, you get your fingerprints taken and pictures and all that. And then, yeah, we were there for a month or so, because they're kind of trying to figure out what you're saying is right or not. And my mom was having interviews like twice a day. She needed to explain who she was. And I think they also double check everything. They have contacts in the embassies around the world in Afghanistan, Kabul, checking if this is true, the person, do we know a general with this name? Mm-hmm. And after a month, we were then deported to another refugee camp in Denmark, which was in the north part of Denmark. And that's where you wait for no matter, like, a very long time. Certain people were there for 4 or 5 months, still waiting for them to get a positive answer or a negative. A positive answer means you can stay for 3 years. A negative answer means goodbye, you've been deported. And the police are going to come, literally, if you're not willing to leave, the police are going to handcuff you, put you in a car next in the airport, and then drop you off wherever you came from. And I remember, yeah, being there for 8 months, I think, while, you know, the process is going on. And everyone has a number, you know, you have a, like, a refugee number. And I remember, you know, my mom's number, and you have, like, this office that everyone goes past the office to see if there's a letter for them, you know. So the letter, you never know, it's a good thing or a bad thing.
Right.
So I used to always go, like, that was my routine, like, every day just to see if there's a letter for my mom. And yeah, so in the camp, that's where I also started playing football, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. How did football come into your life?
Magic. I mean, you know, I think I always feel it was meant to be, almost feel it was my fate to be, you know, my path to be in that camp refugee. I needed to be that place, and I don't know how, but I'm obviously super grateful that it happened that way. So the refugee camp was beside these football fields, a football club, Gook football club. And so the only thing kind of that divided the refugee camp was this like half wood with a lot of trees, and then like a metal fence. And, you know, when you're young, and we used to go to school from like language classes from, was it 8 to 1? And after that, you just had the entire time. And me coming from a country where you weren't allowed to do shit, basically.
Yeah.
So have a freedom to explore. And, you know, I've been a very curious person. We just like be around everywhere from day to night. And very soon we discovered the fields, like amazing fields with the football goals, everything.
And this is right next to the camp. It sounds like you're just an incredible setup. Amazing.
I know, it was. And, you know, so as I said, you had like, you had this wood area, and sometimes you had to go through a little path in the jungle to go to the fields. It was like, I would say almost like half a kilometer of maybe 600-700 meters. But then you will arrive there and you had like amazing fields. And then all the way to the other side, you had the clubhouse. So, you know, and I discovered the game. We were just hanging out like from outside the fences and watching all these teams playing football. And in Denmark, the younger team starts around 3 or 4 p.m. And then the older teams, like, you know, train around 8 p.m., the male teams. So at the beginning, we're just sitting there from 3 p.m. to 8 p.m. to see what's happening. And this is the first time that I saw a girls team playing football. And I was like, oh, my God, is this for real? It sounds very dramatic. It sounds like almost from a movie, but I always describe it, you know, I literally was hearing the angels playing the violin, and the violin was like, oh.
As they're running by you in slow motion.
Had you ever seen women or girls play sports up until that point?
No, never. And I've never seen anyone play sports. Forget women, you know. I knew my dad used to play, you know, for the Afghan national team in hockey, not ice hockey, but just the normal hockey, felt hockey, I guess. Mm-hmm. And he also was very into football. He used to, you know, love the World Cups and all that. But I've personally never seen anything. I remember he gave us our first ball when we were in Afghanistan, but we never played football with it. I tried a couple of times to juggle with it, but otherwise we used to play other games like, you know, dodgeball or, yeah, you know, throwing balls. So when I saw it, that how these girls were playing around with the ball and how smooth they were, especially one girl, I became friends with her later on, you know, I'm still friends with her on Facebook. Her dad was the coach. His name was Bo. And she was doing amazing stuff with the ball. You know, I had like her hair loose, but had little fontaine hair. You know, and have these old Barcelona like, you know, jerseys, almost like blue and red with the stripes.
Yeah. I was like, classics.
So classic, you know. And I remember really wanting to be a part of it. And I think that's where my obsession started with the game. And we were all these kids, you know, running around in a refugee camp, you know, when there was no football on the fields. Otherwise, you know, your courage kind of, I got more and more courage. I was getting closer to the field. At a certain point, we were like acting as their ball boys. So every time they had shooting drills, we used to run in the forest and bring the balls back. And yeah, a couple of months after, I think 3-4 months after, I gathered the courage and asked the coach if I could be a part of the trainings or the like play. I don't know. Because, you know, you were seeing when they're warming up and I was trying to imitate, but it wasn't, you know, you see them there and then later on you go home or in the camp and you're like, okay, she was doing this or this is with the passes. And then I used to literally be with the ball on my feet for hours and hours until my mom would call me to come back and go to bed.
What did it feel like when you finally got on the field or kicked a soccer ball?
I was kicking soccer ball already. I mean, I was kicking a dodgeball already because we saw it and I'm like, oh, they're kicking. Let's kick the same thing. Everyone was chasing the same orange little pinky ball. But being on the field, suddenly I just felt home somehow. You know, I felt calmer. You were looking at what everyone was doing and you were following around and then, you know, the passes. I think a couple of months went by and then I was giving this little note saying that I had, you know, say Saturday, 12 p.m. here, you have your first game. And I was like, God, I have to play a game. I remember running to my mom, like almost screaming that I need cleats. You need to buy me shoes. Everyone else wearing the shoes. I need to play a game. It's important now. She's getting real now. I'm playing a game, you know? And my mom was like, yeah, well, I mean, we have always so money. Everything that I already owned was for the secondhand store. Somehow I had found this green, white, I mean, most of it was green, super retro Irish national team jersey, I think it was. Because I think of the color, now I remember, with number 10 on it. And I used to wear that, I swear by God, every day, day in and day out. And at this point, you know, I'm starting to also watch a lot of football because we had this German TV, RTL 2, where Champions League used to show Champions League and Beckham was the thing at that point. And I was like, Mom, you need to cut my hair like him. So I was rocking the Beckham hair, but the problem was I have curly hair. So my hair was like, I was wearing this same green T-shirt every day in school with jeans. And I had like, I don't know. Oh my God.
Nadia, is that why you wear number 10 today?
Actually, my favorite number is number 9 because of Ronaldo Nazario, the Brazilian. I saw him playing with the 9, I was like, this guy is sick. Like the way he was playing, I wanted to learn everything he was learning. I used to see something and then be out for 8 hours in a row to try to learn that. So I think my favorite number is 9, you know, but I've played most of my life 9, 10, and sometimes 11 when I was younger.
That was me. That was me, Nadia. Double number one, baby.
Let's go. Most of my favorite players that you've seen play with 9, 10, you know, Rivaldo, I used to be a huge fan when I was younger, you know, later on Zidane, I was like, I mean, so Zlatan even play with the 10. So I love playing, you know, with 10 or 9, I don't really care at this point.
Nadia, you talking about the refugee camp and football coming into your life, I imagine you having to watch what was happening in Afghanistan recently was incredibly difficult, given your history. And I believe you were helping some of those women get out as well that I read.
Yeah, I think obviously devastating to see what's happening in the country that I was born in. You know, I feel like all that I've experienced once 20 years ago, and you would think that in 20 years things would change. Also, yeah. You know, I think since the US invaded and tried to bring democracy and tried to fight the Taliban, I thought, okay, things would have changed. And then, I don't know, just last year when I feel the country was almost handed over to them back, I was very confused, and I couldn't understand that how can a terrorist group suddenly become a part of a government? How can they decide millions of people's you know, lives? How is that possible? So in that way, I was, yeah, in shock. And then, of course, in terms of the women's national team, Afghanistan women's national team, you know, at that point, sports is not even on the table. We're talking about education. You're not even allowed to have like the human right, which is like having access to school. This has been taken from you. So sports is out of the question at that point. So yeah, for me, it's hard to watch, just because, you know, I feel bad for the girls and the women in that country. I feel bad because the future looks so dark, and then you know, I can relate. I was born there, and it's horrible. But luckily, you know, as you mentioned, a lot of the women's players got out. Some of them are in Australia and Portugal.
Yeah,
kind of spread everywhere. Yeah, and obviously, I hope for them the best. I hope they have now, they have all the opportunities that they didn't have in Afghanistan, and I wish them the best, and I hope they make the best out of it. My dream is obviously one day to be able to be around the national team and try to, you know, kind of build it up somehow, maybe from behind and being one of the supporting roles. But for now, as it looks, it's very hard because you're not allowed to do any sports.
And you're talking the Afghanistan national team for women. You want to help build that back up someday.
I would love to be a part of building the team, like, you know, the sports in Afghanistan, because I think football has such amazing power. It's a great tool to do this stuff, you know, to bring a change, to try to improve people's life, to try to give them courage to, you know, to teach them about life in general. So because it's done it for me, and I would love them to experience the same things.
I can't wait to watch you in these next 10 years, honestly. Yeah, I'm just going to sit back and be like, all right, Nadia, go run that world, sister. Go run it.
I swear, my God, I have so many plans, you know. I just feel sometimes I'm like, okay, I need to start going. But you know what? I hope I'm not the only one. I know that this new generation of athletes in general, you know, they have so much on their heart. You know, you see big things happening around, like, female athletes in particular. It makes me proud. It makes me happy to see that they actually use their platform
to do good,
you know?
Yeah. Okay. Next, I hope you're ready for this, Nadia. It will not require your knee yet, so you should be fine. Wow. It's the Lin game.
Okay.
Nadia, you are about to go head to head with Julie in a trivia game.
Oh, wow.
All of the questions are multiple choice.
Okay.
There are 5 questions, best of 5 wins. At any point when I read the question and you think you know the answer, you can make your noise to chime in. You don't have to wait for me to read the whole question.
What kind of noise?
Well, that is the next question. What is your noisemaker?
Can I use this?
Boom. Oh. It's like a fan against Nadia's hand. And Jules, what do you have today?
I have my squeaky toy, which I'm not going to squeak because Swaggy is right underneath me and she will go apeshit, as we know.
Okay.
My dog. You're gonna be introduced to her in 1 second, Nadia, because I'm going to crush this game. Okay. I've been losing and it's time for me to crush this.
Are you already trash talking? Okay,
depends. Yes.
Okay, let's
go. Good luck.
The theme of this game is random stuff in medicine.
Oh, wow.
No. Okay.
No pressure.
Julie, you can brush off your...
I was going to go to med school as well, Nadia, back in the day.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
You probably know this already, this answer.
No, that was like 5 centuries ago. Okay.
Question one. What condition sometimes causes sufferers of strokes or traumatic brain injuries to speak with a different accent? Is it a different? Yeah, they speak with a foreign accent. A different accent. Is it A? What's it called? Is it a dizzy dialect? B, foreign accent syndrome, or C, Murray tongue disorder? Julie.
I'm getting in early because I have no idea, but I'm going with Murray tongue disorder.
Incorrect. No! Nadia, your choices are dizzy dialect or foreign accent syndrome.
I'm going to go with the foreign accent syndrome.
Correct.
Good try though, Julie. Good try. Good.
Thank you. Thank
Question
you.
Two. Okay. What are blood cells shaped like? A, donuts. B, bananas, or C, pears?
Donuts.
I got that one, right? I'm going with donuts.
Well, I did it first. Well, I was thinking
I spit it first.
This is where it gets tough over Zoom because I don't have instant replay. We're gonna give it to Julie on this one so she can have a shot.
Yes. One to one.
Or we say it's a wash, because honestly I couldn't tell.
I'll take it.
Question three.
Swaggy.
What does a rhinologist specialize in? Nadia.
Nose.
Correct.
Did not know that one. Rhinologist? Never heard of it.
Jesus.
See, I'm telling you, it was 5 centuries ago. Okay.
You can take the game with this one, Nadia. Question four. Approximately what percentage does laughing increase blood flow? Is it A, 20%, B, 50%, or C, 100%?
What was it?
Oh. I'm going to give it to, just to keep it interesting, I'm giving it to Julie because it was really close.
50%. B.
Incorrect.
Oh, come on.
Nadia, is it 20% or 100%?
20.
Correct.
Good try, Julie. Good try.
Dr. Nadim takes the win.
Well, I mean, this was very random questions, but thank you. Appreciate this. You did well, Julie. You did well.
Thank you, Nadia. Thank you, Dr. Nadim. Dr. Nadim. All right, most pressing questions. Nadia.
Yes.
You speak 9 languages. Can you say, I'll have a donut the size of my head in at least 2 different languages?
Yeah. In size of my head?
Yeah, I'll have a donut the size of my head.
Yeah, again, hand donut, postures, and
what language was that?
That was Danish. And
okay.
I'm going to go German. Ich würde gerne ein Donut haben, die Größe of mein Kopf.
Mein Kopf! How do you speak 9 languages?
I don't know, Julia. I'm very smart. Tell me.
Best answer ever.
I don't know. I'm very smart. Okay. Nadia, please tell me something you don't do well.
There's probably a lot of things I don't do well.
I haven't found any.
But the thing is, for me, it doesn't really matter if you do well, if you don't do it well. As long as you every day progress and you feel like there's a bit of movement, then it's okay.
Snap it!
You don't have to, you don't have to be expert in anything, you know, it's just like your own development. I think that's the crucial part. And I think, as I said, there's a million of things I'm probably not great at, but you know what? One thing I know that is if I work on it, it always gets better.
Oh, my God. So good. I would have just said, yeah, I do everything well. Thanks.
Of course, yeah.
Okay. Our last segment, Nadia's high, low cheer. This is going to be the high of your career, the low of your career, and the cheer is for someone you're grateful for who's helped you along the way. So can you give, we'll start with your high.
One of the highest moments of my career was probably getting my debut for the national team against US. I remember playing against Christy Rampone and I was subbed in 20 minutes in the game because our striker got injured with her groin. And then I had to man mark Abby Wambach the rest of my game. And she didn't score that game. So it ended up me marking her the entire career every time we played. And, you know, so I think that was like one of the highest moments of my career, obviously, because it was such a big moment for me.
Oh, love it. And Abby scores a lot. So that is a big high.
You know, I think every time, I remember so many times in the corner kicks, she's a beast and she's so good in the air, the way she times it. And I'm not that big, but still, I think every time I man marked her, I don't think she scored. I'm just saying this.
You're in her head. You were in her head for sure.
I told her this when I met her. I'm like, Abby, you never scored against me. And she's like, what, really?
You haunted her. Okay. And you're low.
My lowest, that's a hard one, you know. I think obviously being injured is very low, but again, that's a part of the game. I think, you know, I am losing the Euros was a hard one to swallow. You know what? I know which one is my lowest. I remember feeling shit afterwards, very shit. In Portland, when we lost, it was a semifinals, first playoff game or semifinals against North Carolina. Yeah, I got injured in that game also in my knee. Sam Mewis injured me. I remember feeling so bad, you know, because I really wanted to win the first year of the league.
Yeah.
That was a low one. But I think there's been so many also low ones because it's just a part of life. It goes like this, up and down, especially. But most likely injuries.
Okay. And your cheer?
I think my youth coach in Denmark, his name was Brian. He was someone, you know, that kind of almost took me under his wing like an older brother. And I think I was very, how do you say, warm-headed or red-headed. You know, like my temperament used to just flow.
Yeah. Warm-headed, I like that. Yes. Yeah, hot-headed, we call it. But I like warm-headed.
Yeah, sorry. but I remember him telling me to, Nadia, every time you get so, like, angry or in the red zone, use your feet, show them with your feet. I think this is the thing always taken to me. So he obviously helped me a lot during my career, often on the field.
Oh man, so
super
good.
Quick, I'm going to sneak this in here. Nadia, I saw you have step by step quite a bit on your Instagram. What does that mean to you?
I mean, I have phases, you know. I think for me, as I said, progress is very important. And I think this things that you can see from every day, you know, you take steps every day. And then at the end, you look back and you've literally walked a marathon. I think most people when they go wrong is that they look at the entire marathon and they're like, oh, this looks impossible. What I always try to concentrate on is like what I have in front of me. You know, I can only work on one step at a time or one jump at a time. And this has been, you know, something that's followed me, that one. And I have also started from bottom now we're here. I used to write this all the time. It was my hashtag. I don't know. I think they kind of tell.
What was your hashtag? Say it again.
It was like start from the bottom. Now we're here. The Drake song. Hashtag is, you know, I take it to the step out of the time. And then, you know, also, I think, I don't know if this is an American or English saying, but in Persian, they say, qadra qadra darya mesha. So by each drop, you can actually create a sea.
Yeah.
So it's kind of the same thing, like step by step, you can walk an entire marathon. I know. So as I said, I always try to just do the minimal. Of course, you want to do more, but like for every day, if you just take one step, you've moved one step compared to.
Oh, you are a gift, my friend. Thank you for sharing your story, because I know it has inspired so many, and we're just so honored to be able to share it on our podcast. And for you to be so candid about all of it is incredible. So I can't thank you enough. I know you're slammed with stuff too, Nadia. So thank you, my dear.
Of course, anytime, anything for you, Julie.
Oh, right back at you, Dr. Nadine. Anything for you as well. I hope they get that jersey done, honestly. I've already put in my 2 cents at Racing Louisville. I was like, get that jersey done. Stat. So proud of her. Amazing human. All right. Takeaways, Lynn.
Go for it.
I actually have 2. Because when I asked her, how do you speak 9 languages? And without hesitation, she said, because I'm very smart. Duh. I thought that was the best answer I've ever heard.
Agreed.
To any question ever asked in the universe. Mm-hmm. Well done. And then I also love when I asked in the most pressing questions, please tell me something that you're not good at. Her immediate response was great as well, because she said a lot of things, and that's okay. Mm. The point being is that I'm making progress in all of them. I'm growing to get better.
Mm-hmm.
And she talked about her own development, and it's about your own development. If I can work on it and I keep growing, then I'm always getting better, and that's what I keep as a mindset. And I just thought,
I know.
So good.
Yeah, I felt the same way, and I'll roll right into my takeaway when Nadia said, step by step, you can walk an entire marathon.
Yeah. And it's such an important frame of mind. Instead of being so hard on ourselves, instead be of the mindset, I'm actually getting better. Look at that.
Yeah.
Step by step. Because as we know, we can have the tendency to go hard on ourselves. So good reminder from Dr. Nadim. Questions permitted, Lynn.
Jules, this comes from kcrumbly45 on Instagram. What is your favorite joke to tell?
Oh, Kate, you're the best for asking. How much time do we have? I have to just pick one?
It said, what is your favorite? Didn't say, what are your favorites?
No, it's not plural, is it?
No.
Maybe we just do a podcast on all my jokes one time. I would say my favorite joke to tell is this. I'm very partial to vegetable jokes. So there were 2 olives walking down the street. And they're cruising along, these 2 olives chatting away. And then all of a sudden, it's not a busy road at all. It's just them on the street. This big semi truck comes racing down this street, and the olives have to jump off to the side. And one olive, Joe, is not getting up. So his friend goes over to him and he's like, Joe. And he's hollering at Joe. Joe is not moving. He's like, Joe. He's starting to get worried. Joe, are you okay, Joe? Joe is not moving. So the friend starts to panic and he's shaking Joe. And he's like, Joe, wake up, Joe. Are you all right? Finally, Joe starts to come to. And he's like dusting himself. He's like, Joe, are you all right? And Joe goes, I'll live. I'll live.
Oh my gosh. I have so much commentary about this because, one, I think you've told this joke before.
How many times have you heard me tell this joke at Leadership Academy? I tell it every year.
And then the other thing is, I remembered the punchline, you know, probably about halfway through. But But three, I still absolutely loved the journey to get there.
It's all about the energy in which you tell a joke. So I try these on my kids and I start giggling before the punchline. Mm-hmm. And they're like, look at you. Look at you. You're already laughing and you haven't even told us the joke. I'm like, God, it's so good. It's an anticipation of how good it is. And then they just look at me. They don't laugh. Declan literally will just look at me and go, what's wrong with you?
Come on, Declan.
I know. Does that on purpose just to make me mad. I'm like, that is funny. He's like, it's not funny, Mom. Okay. Thank you, Kate, for that question. Don't forget would you all.
Would you like my favorite joke to tell?
Oh, yeah. I would like your favorite joke.
Did you hear the one about the unsharpened pencil? Mm. It didn't have a point.
I was like, I know I've heard this one. What do you call a deer with no eyes?
No idea.
I got no idea. Okay, that does it for us. Don't forget that you too can ask really on point, important questions like Kate in our Questions Permitted episode.
I don't know if it's K Crumley. It was just the letter K.
Like, so the letter K.
I'm not 100%
all right,
sure.
Sorry,
if Kate.
It might not be Kate. We'll just say K.
Great question.
But don't forget, you know, the more serious, the better. We like to roll very hardcore, hard-hitting here. That does it for us. Thank you to our dope village for listening. We love all of your comments you send our way, so hit us up on social media some more, please. And also, while you're at it, if you could subscribe, rate, and leave us a comment on our Apple Podcast page. That helps us out a ton. A big thanks to our sponsors. Yes, Ally from the very beginning, and Dick's Sporting Goods, and to Kate Diaz, who's also been with us from the very beginning, who wrote and composed our theme music. She is a Julie Foudy Sports Leadership Academy alumni. Yes, she is. And remember, kids, as always, sing it with us.
Laughter permitted.
I don't know, Julie. I'm very smart.